Okay, folks, please settle in as I'm neither Rochester nor CFA, so freebie. Okay, folks. I know you're excited about the quiz. So here's what. So here's what's going to happen. In about 2 minutes, gotta wait for people to settle in. Okay. So here's the sequence. Folks, come on. So here's the sequence of what's going to happen. In about 2 or 3 minutes, the TAs are going to come here and pick up the quizzes. Hey guys, the quiz is over. Can you please stop talking? In about 2 or 3 minutes, the quizzes are going to get picked up by the TAs and they're going to be put in alphabetical order while I finish the class. Hopefully they'll be done by 5 o'clock or 4:45 when the class is over. The quizzes will be put in alphabetical order. It's not graded yet. I will start grading, obviously, after I finish this class. I can't grade while I teach. First, I'll teach the grade the valuation MBA quizzes that got done this morning. And then I will start on your quizzes. But when the quizzes are done, you will get an email from me saying, and it's probably going to be sooner than you think, that the quizzes are done. Come and pick them up. You're saying, where? It'll be on the 9th floor for KMAC. It'll be face down in alphabetical order. That's why I made you write your name on the back. If you did not, not the end of the world. I hope you wrote your name at least one place on the quiz. Because in algebra, you can have only one unknown in an equation. So if you wrote your name somewhere, I'm going to put it on the back. It'll be face down in alphabetical order. And I'd like you to take your quiz and not treat this like a bookstore. Don't browse through the quizzes. Don't look at what other people got. If any of you feel that this is going to be a gigantic invasion of your privacy to have your quiz sitting out there, let me know. I will keep the quiz in my office, but then you'll have to wait till I'm in my office to pick up your quiz. If you want your quiz to be available when it's available, it'll go to that alphabetical order and you can pick up your quiz. I will, that email, when I tell you the quizzes are done, I will also send you the solution to the quiz with a grading template. Because I'll start grading, I'll have a template. It's going to be pretty transparent about where you lost points, if you did lose points. Please check your quiz, because I have I have 500 quizzes that I'll be grading. And there'll be a point this evening, especially late in the evening, where I'm going to get very sloppy and miss some things. So if I miss something in your quiz, bring it to my attention. I know how this game plays. It works. Quizzes, the mistakes in your favor, you will not bring to my attention. I fully understand that. But mistakes that work against you, I will fix. Okay. Hopefully, I don't make that many mistakes, but I do make mistakes. So please check your quizzes against the solution. Make sure that you are being treated fairly in terms of how many points I'm taking off and not taking off. Okay. So the reason I'm not going to send you the solution right after class today is I know exactly what will happen if I send you the solution right after class. You will assume that you get no credit for any mistake. You'll be convinced that all of you are going to get zeros. And the next thing I know, you're going to freak out between today and tomorrow. So the solutions won't be ready until your quiz is also ready, so you can see what you actually got. So with that long lead in, let's continue with what we were talking about, which is growth rates. Okay, so in the last session, we talked about sustainable growth. And sustainable growth, we said, is about answering two questions. How much are you reinvesting? How well are you reinvesting? whether you measure the return on equity or return invested capital or non-cash ROE, you're trying to do exactly the same thing. You're trying to figure out how much growth the company can get based on what it's doing. So today I want to complete that discussion, because that equation of growth is equal to reinvestment rate times return on capital works if your return on capital is stable. So if you have a 12% return on capital from now through ever, you can use a sustainable growth equation. But if your return on capital is changing, you're going to have a second component on your growth. Think of what? Let's assume you have a company with a return on capital right now of 10%. It reinvests nothing. Its reinvestment rate is zero. If I use a sustainable growth equation, your reinvestment rate is zero, what should your growth rate be? Zero, right? But let's say this company is able to improve its return on capital from 10% to 15%. It's reinvesting nothing, right? But if you take what it's going to make as earnings this year, it's 10%. Let's say you have $1 billion of capital invested. 10% of $1 billion is 100 million. Next year, they're going to make 15% of $1 billion. That's 150 million. You're going to get a 50% growth rate next year if you go from 10 to 15%. That's called efficiency growth. It's great growth because you don't have to really reinvest for it. The only problem is it comes with an end, right? You can't keep depending on efficiency to grow. But if you can grow with efficiency, of course, that's the first place you're going to go. So that component of changing return on capital will mean that you can have a company with a low reinvestment and low return on capital actually be able to grow at a higher rate because it's improving its return on capital. Thank God for that. Because if you have a company with a low return on capital, you're going to feel doomed, right? Because you take a low return on capital, any sustainable growth equation on that low return on capital is going to give you a low growth rate. The Adani Group's return on capital is 3.6%. How fast can you grow when your return on capital is 3.6% if it stays at 3.6%? You need efficiency growth at those companies to get any kind of growth. So I'm going to do a little exercise, and I'm going to show you five companies that all have the same growth in earnings. And I want you to rank them from high growth to low growth. So as you look at these companies, you'll notice the bottom line growth is the same, but I want you to think about which of these companies has the most valuable growth and which one has the least valuable growth, right? So all of these companies have 10% growth rates. They all look the same in terms of growth. But the way they get there is very different. The first company has a reinvestment rate of, so you can see different combinations of reinvestment rate and return on capital and different returns on invested capital. So I want you to think about which of these companies has the least valuable growth. In fact, it can be value destroying growth. Which of these companies has the worst growth rate? Even though the growth rate looks the same, which one is going to create the least value? And what is it about three that should worry you? They're growing, but they're reinvesting huge amounts at a return on capital of 5% that's actually lower than the cost of capital. They're growing, but it's terrible growth. In terms of best possible growth, if I ask you for a one-year growth, you'd obviously want all of it to come from efficiency, right? Because you're reinvesting nothing. But remember, it's a one-year growth rate. The companies that generate the most value, the companies that earn high returns on capital, because now you're getting the same growth rate with far less reinvestment. When you look at your company and you see a bottom line growth rate of 15, 20, 25%, it's easy to get dazzled by growth rates. But take a step back and say, how is this growth being created? How much are they reinvesting to generate the growth? Because the more you're reinvesting to get that same growth rate, the less valuable you become as a company. So value of growth essentially comes from how much you reinvest, how well you reinvest, and it can add value, destroy value, or do nothing for value. Any questions on those two drivers of value, reinvestment rate and return on capital? So with that lead in, let's talk about the most generic way of thinking about growth. And this is basically your guidance on using that Ginzu spreadsheet. The Ginzu spreadsheet is designed for any type of company, stable growth, stable return capital, unstable return capital, rising margins, dropping margins. So I'm going to take you through the process by which you can take any company, money losing, money making, young, old, and think about projecting future numbers. When your margins are changing, you have to start with revenues. You see why? Because if your margins are changing, forecasting operating income becomes a crapshoot. you're going to start by projecting revenue. So we're going to talk about, hey, how do we get revenue growth rates? Why 10% as opposed to 30%? But that's going to be the driver of growth in your company's revenue growth. So you got to take into account how big your company is, how big the market is. Your story will drive that growth rate. So that's a revenue growth rate. Second stop, you got to take a look at the margins. Are the margins going to rise over time, drop over time? What are you going to look at? You're going to look at the competition. You're going to look at the company. You're going to look at its competitive advantages. The margin times revenues is going to give you operating income. And then the third leg is to grow your revenues, you got to tell me how much you need to reinvest. Because I'm focusing on revenues, I now have to tie invested capital, not to operating income, but to revenues. That sales to invested capital, just my shortcut for saying, hey, for any given investment in capital, how much revenue are you generating as a company? The higher that number, the more efficiently you're generating growth. So how quickly are you growing? How profitable is your business model? How much are you reinvesting to get that future growth? I challenge you to find me any non-financial service company where you can't capture its business model with those three questions. Let's take each one separately. Let's say you have a company and ask you, what's your revenue growth rate? Do you want to give me a high number or a low number if it's your company? What do you want? You want a high number, right? So if I left each variable, I want you to think about, you want a high revenue growth rate. Then I turn to margin. What would you like your margin to look like over time, to become a high margin or a low margin? You want a high margin. Then I ask you about reinvestment. Do you want a high reinvestment or a low reinvestment? You want to be able to get away with as little reinvestment as possible. Left to your own devices, you're going to pick and choose. I want high margins, high growth, low reinvestment. And in a world where you can tell fairy tales, that's exactly where you're going to go, right? You're going to get 50% growth in revenues, your margins are going to end up at 70%. You're going to reinvest nothing, and you're going to be worth trillions of dollars. But here's the problem. When you make forecasts of these numbers, you've got to think about the market you're in, the world you're in, the business you're in. So let's take each of these numbers and talk a little bit about some of the things you're going to focus on to decide whether to give your company a high growth rate or low growth rate. So let's take revenue growth. The first and biggest issue you've got to wrestle with when you think about revenue growth is, how big is the market that I'm going after? This is in Silicon Valley. It's called TAM, or total addressable market. It's become this game that people play. But if you're realistic, you're saying, I am a company in a business. I want to see how big the market is. I need to know how big the market is to get a sense of how quickly my company can grow. The reason this is a little subjective is, I'll give you an example. When I first valued Uber in 2013, remind me again what business Uber was in 2013. Remember, this was before food delivery. They were a car service company, right? A ride-sharing company is a car service company. So what's the total market? It's taxi cabs and, you know, at that time, limo companies. I added all the numbers up and I came up with a total addressable market of 100 billion, and I screwed up. I was right about the total addressable market, but what I wasn't factoring in was Uber was changing behavior to the point that people who would not use car service would use car service for things they didn't need. My youngest son was on my credit card for a long time with Uber. And on Saturday nights, I'd get like 7 Uber charges. I think he was using Uber to go from the bedroom to the bathroom. Right? It was like, no, $6 here, $4 there, $15 here. I mean, things he would never have done in a taxi cab. You know what that means, right? That $100 billion total addressable market has become like $350 billion. Because not only have people's behavior changed, but in the Bay Area, people have stopped buying their own cars. Why buy a car, pay for parking, pay for insurance, when there's a ride-sharing service right outside? That is what I missed in 2013. If you look at my subsequent valuation of Uber, my total addressable market has to factor in that behavior changes. Companies have learned from Uber. So essentially now, when companies come out with their estimates of total addressable market, they balloon out the market. Uber, when they went public in 2019, in their IPO, said that total addressable market was $5.2 trillion. You know how they came up with the 5.2 trillion? They took what people were spending on buying cars. They put in there mass transit there. Basically, they took everything that anybody ever spent on transportation and threw it in there. It's completely completely unrealistic, right? But you know why they want to hold the 5.2 trillion up to you? Because you as an investor are going to look at the 5.2 trillion and you're going to jump to the conclusion then, hey, Uber can have $1 trillion in revenues. There's zero chance of that happening. But companies have learned. Airbnb, when it went public, said its total addressable market was $3 trillion. You know what hotels collectively made as revenues in 2020? $600 billion. I know Airbnb is going to draw people into the hospitality business who might not have gone, but it's not going to make the market five times. There's a lot of gaming in total markets, and you can see why. You're not in Silicon Valley selling a business. You're trying to value business. You have to be realistic. So if you see estimates of total addressable market for your company, it's your job to ask, does that make sense? But you're going to start with it. The second component you got to ask is what percentage of that market will be mine, right? So if you tell me the total addressable market is a trillion, let's say it's a realistic estimate, you got to tell me, hey, are you going to get 30% of the market, 40, 50, or 10%? And what will drive that market share is the business economics of that market. One of the things that technology has done is it's created more winner-take-all markets. I'll give you an example. The old days, advertising was a very splintered business because if you wanted to advertise in New York, you put your ad in the New York Times. If you want to invest in LA, you put in the LA Times. There was no way that if you wanted to invest in the UK, you're going to go through a US media because people in the UK didn't watch. You know how Google and Facebook changed that? If you're Google or Facebook, you're not constrained by geography. You essentially can go out and appeal to the entire market. And that's essentially changed the advertising business. Google and Facebook, you know, together control about 60% of all of the online advertising business. And that's happening in market after market. How does it play out? It's called networking benefits, where basically the larger you get as a company, the easier it becomes for you to grow because, you know, advertisers want to go where everybody else is. What I'm trying to say is when you try to estimate your revenue growth rate, your challenge is figuring out what's the market I'm going after. So you got to figure out what that market is and what percentage of the market will be mine. And that's a market share. And within that business, you got to ask, if I'm competing against four other companies, what are my competitive advantages? Why would I get a higher market share than somebody else? What do I do differently? So that combination is what's going to tell you whether your company can end up with $100 billion in revenues in year 10 or $1 trillion in revenues. I know I've been sending you the valuation of the week. I think you've even stopped looking at them. You should look at the Star Wars one, though. That was one of my favorite valuations of all time. I did it right after I saw Force One. Now, it was around Christmas, and we have this tradition in our family. On Christmas Eve, we go to a movie, take the stress off, you know, gift giving. And we went to Force One. We come back home, and then I tell my family, look, I have something to do. This is Christmas Eve. What do you want to do? I say, I feel the urge to value the Star Wars franchise. I said, Dad, you're weird. But you know what? I did. So what you see in that original blog post was a Christmas Eve post on here's how. It's a fun valuation because it talks about how do you value a franchise like Star Wars? Of course, at the movies. But remember, this is a franchise that's lived on merchandising, right? I mean, George Lucas created an entire universe. I think thousands of, this is a merchandiser's dream. Think of all the different characters you can create. So it's essentially but when you think about, you know, valuing a company, you've got to step back and say, hey, what is the business I'm going after? What is the market share? That's going to tell you what kind of revenue growth to do. But take a look at my Tesla valuation because I had to wrestle with these, right? What's a total addressable market? Presumably anybody who buys a car and the percentage of those cars to be electric cars. Already you can make judgment calls, right? The number of cars sold is not going to dramatically shoot up. It's about 80 to 90 million. It's been around that number. In fact, you could argue that it might actually decrease over time. But the percentage of those cars that are going to be electric cars is going to rise. So if you're an optimist about Tesla, you're assuming that that percentage will be 60, 70, or even 100% of all cars sold. So that's going to give me the total market. I then have to estimate what percentage of that market will belong to Tesla. So again, you're making judgment calls. How much more advanced is a Tesla electric car than a Ford electric car or a Volvo electric car? And will that difference persist over time? Because that's going to make a difference as to whether you get 60% market share, 40th. No automobile company in history has ever had a market share that exceeds 20%. Why? Because there are so many different segments to the market, right? You've got mass automobiles, luxury. It's very difficult to be all things to all people. So Volkswagen and Toyota right now, about 10% market shares. That's pretty much the peak. Maybe Tesla will be different. Maybe the nature of the business will give them 30% market shares. But to estimate revenue growth for Tesla, I had to make those judgments. Is it easy? Of course not. Are you going to be wrong? Absolutely. But how can you make value Tesla without making judgments on those factors? And those will all feed into your revenue growth numbers. So if any of you have a young company that you're valuing, well, with more mature companies, you can get away with cheating, right? You can look at the historical growth, Coca-Cola, who cares what the total addressable market looks like? You're giving them 5% growth on a pretty big market share, and the market is pretty mature. But if you're valuing a company that's young, it's evolving, it's changing, it could be an Airbnb still, it could be a Peloton, you have to make some judgment. Peloton, the judgment you're making is, what percentage of people are going to shift away from exercising in gyms to shift to exercising at home? What percentage of those people will want to spend the $2,000 or $4,000 it takes to buy a Peloton bike or a Peloton treadmill? And how many of those people will pay $40 a month? I remember when Peloton went public, there's a sell-side equity research analyst who came on CNBC and said, everybody has Pelotons. He said, God, you need to get out of your apartment building in New York and walk a few blocks. Maybe you live in an apartment building where everybody has Peloton, but trust me, very few people can afford to pay $480 a year for Peloton subscriptions on top of a $4,000. So when you think about revenue growth, think about these factors because they will all come into play. So I'll take you, later on, I'll show you my Airbnb valuation. But when I valued Airbnb, I started by looking at the hotel business. No, I learned my lessons from Uber saying, but I wanted to start there because I need to know what people spend on hotels before I can make judgment calls on Airbnb. So what you see to the left is you basically see the size of the hotel business. In 2019, which is a year before Airbnb went public, hotels collectively had revenues of $630 billion. So that's a collective revenues at all publicly traded hotels around the world, $630 billion. If you look at the business itself, it's pretty concentrated. So this is a traditional hotel business. A few big hotel names control the business, the Marriott's, the Hilton. So basically, you can go through the list. So this is a business that's pretty big. It's concentrated. For whatever reason, people prefer to go to chains that they recognize. They don't want to go to it. And finally, if you look at the market size, the US is the biggest market, but China is catching up. That's basically, you're getting perspective. You're just saying, this is not about Airbnb. Let me get a sense of the market. And I would strongly suggest that that's where you start. Look at the existing business, look at the players, because you gotta try to get a sense of what drives this market. So if you look at the Airbnb prospectus though, they estimate their serviceable, Silicon Valley loves to make up acronyms. So they have this serviceable addressable market. It's called SAM. And they won't even use service. They would say the SAM is, and you say, so what's SAM? That's part of the reason they use words like this. You have no idea what they're talking about. The SAM is 1.5 trillion, including 1.2 trillion. So they give you details, but their total addressable market they claimed was 3.4 trillion, that they could sell other services as part of Airbnb. If you notice, if you rent on Airbnb, it used to be that the host would offer you, if you're going to say, they'd offer you touring services that they take. They've given up on that because very clearly, it doesn't make sense to bundle it all into your host, right? So if you want to visit a city and you want to tour the city, you don't want your host to be the tour guide because he or she might not be the best tour guide. But Airbnb had this vision of, we're going to bundle this stuff. And the objective here is to make the market as big as possible, which would then make higher revenues, therefore more feasible. So try your best. As I said, you're going to be wrong, but you have to make that judgment call on what the market is and what the market share is to basically get a sense of what revenue growth can I use for my company. As I said, don't look at the growth rates. Look at the revenues you have in year 10 and ask yourself, can my company story sustain those revenues? Let's move to margins. Okay. So right now, your margin can be any number, right? If you're a young company, it could be minus 3%, minus 10%, minus 50%, depending on how young it is. I'm not interested in what your existing margin is. I'm interested in what your margin can be in steady state. You know what drives us? I mean, as I said, if I gave you a choice, you'd all like 70% margins, right? But margins are determined by unit economics. What are unit economics? It's what you make on that extra unit that you sell. If you're in a business where the extra unit you sell costs you almost nothing, you can have much higher margins than a business that has to spend a lot of money to generate the extra unit. I'm not trying to be mysterious, but how much does it cost Microsoft to sell an extra copy of Office? I mean, you can't even call it a copy. Everything is digital. You go on Microsoft and say, I want to be an Office 365 subscriber. You think there's some person scurrying around saying, I need to produce a copy of Office 365. Somebody just bought it. It costs them almost nothing. So when you look at the operating margins for Microsoft, you see numbers like 35, 40, 45% margins, because almost all of what they sell is pure profit. In contrast, if you buy a Tesla, no matter how well it's run, you expect a car delivered, right? Not a virtual car, but a real car. They have to make the car. And I know this is stating the obvious. And making the car, no matter how efficient you are, will cost you money. The way this shows up is there's a number called gross margin. Gross margin is the difference between what you get on the extra unit and what it costs. So if you look at your company's gross margin, if your gross margins are 70, 80, or 85%, your operating margins can be high. So even money-losing companies, if they're in business with good unit economics, the gross margins will look great. The net margins or operating margins will be terrible because they have other costs. But they can grow out of them. But if your gross margins are low, you can't tell me that your operating margin is going to be 70 or 80% if your gross margin is only 30%. Tesla's gross margin last year was about 30%. That's actually very good for an automobile company. But it also means that when I hear Cathie Wood saying there's going to be an EBITDA margin of 60% in Tesla, I've got to ask, what exactly are they selling? It's got to be software, right? It can't be a car. There's a story I can tell for Tesla. You know that a Tesla without its software is just a pile of junk, right? Because you take the software out of the Tesla, nothing works. I mean, let me tell you a story. You might say, I would never pay for that. Let's say you buy a Tesla. And I tell you, every year from now on, it'll cost you $2,000 to upgrade your software. Changes the model entirely, right? That is the story we'll need to tell for Tesla to be worth what it is there's a side product they're selling where the unit economics are such they can generate much higher margins because the automobile business has bad unit economics. It takes you a lot of money to build the car and sell it. You're not going to make the margins that a software company does. So look at unit economics, and there's also a trade-off. If you're going to give your company high growth and a high market share, it's fine, right? But think of how you get a high market share. Often you got to cut prices. You can't be charging $60,000 for a car like Tesla is and expect to get a 40% market share. Why? Because people don't have the money to spend. Because remember, we're talking about the market around the world. You're talking about Chinese consumers and Indian consumers paying $60,000. There is no way you're going to get a NIO is going to beat you every single time to selling the cars. What does that mean? There's a trade-off here. If you want to give your company high revenue growth, I will not contest you. But then if you also give them high operating margins, I'm going to ask you, well, how exactly is that happening? You might tell me a story where you can pull that off. But essentially, your inputs for growth and margins can't be independent. They've got to be tied together by a story that actually makes sense. So what you target as a margin is going to be driven by what kind of business model you have, what are the unit economics, and that's going to determine where you end up, whether you end up with a 7% margin, a 15% margin. So when I ask you, what's your target margin 10 years from on the Ginza spreadsheet? Don't just sit there and say, I'd like a high margin, let me enter 40%. Look at your business, look at the other companies in the business and make sure the margin you're entering is a number that is sustainable. Which brings me to what I did for Airbnb. For Airbnb, the operating margin I had when I started the valuation was minus 10%. The typical operating margin for a hotel company is about 11 or 12%. If I'd valued Airbnb as a hotel company, the margins would have converged 11 to 12%. But Airbnb is not a typical hotel company, right? It's an intermediary. Because it's an intermediary, the unit economics work in their favor. So rather than look at hotel companies for margins, I looked at Expedia and Booking.com. Booking.com in particular is like an old-fashioned, it's an old economy Airbnb. They were around before Airbnb. What was different was Booking.com worked with existing hotels. They didn't bring in apartments. Now they're starting to bring in apartments. The margins you see there are more reflective of what an intermediary can make. So as you value a company, you think about revenue growth and margins and how much will they reinvest. Think about the economics of the business. What are they structured as? And what makes your business more attractive on one dimension can make them less attractive on another one. What gives them high growth might also push down the margins for that business. So you've got revenue growth, got a framework for thinking about margins. Let's bring in third input. And this is the input on which you're going to struggle with because you have no, you know, when you look at it, sales to capital, what the heck is that? You know? You're going to wonder, now what can I do to come up with the number? So let me again set up the structure. Sales to capital, you're taking revenues and dividing by invested capital. Remember how we did return on invested capital? We took after-tax operating income and divide. That same invested capital, I'm dividing revenues by the, you're saying, what does that tell me? The more efficiently you can generate revenues, the higher that ratio should be. So companies that which are efficient about generating revenues should have much higher sales to capital ratios. So what will determine that efficiency? It could be that, you know, and again, let's use Tesla as an example. For the longest time, Tesla has pushed for a very different way of manufacturing cars than the typical automobile company. More robots online, you know, more mechanized, more automated production. And the center of an electric car is the battery. So the extent that you can make the cost of the battery drop and you can deliver it efficiently, you can push up your sales to capital ratio. And here again, if you are a Tesla optimist, they've done some really good thing. The sales to capital ratio for Tesla is about twice as high as the sales to capital ratio for a typical automobile company. You got to give Elon Musk credit. In a sense, not only has he come up with, you know, has he made the electric car the center of the automobile business, he's kind of shaken up existing ways of thinking about automobile. Because when he first started, people said, you've got to build big assembly plants. There's no way you can make cars without having the, if you've ever been to Michigan and you've been by one of those old automobile plants, they're like, you know, they stretch for miles, huge, huge, huge contraptions, extraordinarily capital intensive. And he said, why? Why should I do that? He actually, the Fremont plant was actually a GM plant that he took over, which is his first, the first Tesla plant. It produced about 50,000 GM cars. He made it produce 250,000 Tesla cars. So in a sense, he figured out a way to kind of take existing models and say, let's make them more efficient. So sales to capital ratio is essentially a measure of how efficiently can you generate revenues. So left to your own devices, you want to use a high number there. But you're going to be constrained by, first, what the business you're in. In some businesses, as you get bigger, you might be able to increase the sales to capital ratio. In other words, you get more efficient. In other businesses, you might actually find the sales to capital ratio decreasing. So when I ask you what the sales to capital ratio is, I give you three chances to give me that number. I say, what is it next year? What is it for year 2 through 5? What is it beyond year 5, to give you a chance of saying, hey, as my company gets bigger, my sales to capital ratio could change. And it'll depend on the economics of your business. Second, if you have a company with excess capacity, doesn't have to be a manufacturing company, it could be a service company. You know what you basically get? You get a freebie for the first few years. You're able to grow with relatively little reinvestment. Your sales to capital ratio can be high for the next year, the next 2 years, the next 5 years, because you're living off excess capacity. Again, take a look at my Tesla valuation, because now you can look at it fresh eyes and say, why did he use a sales to capital ratio of 5 for the next 5 years? Because the Shanghai plant had just gone online when I did that valuation. It's only partially used with COVID. It's been slowed down. That plant has the capacity to cover their revenue growth for the next 3 or 4 years. And I'm giving them the credit for that by saying, look, I'll allow you to have a much higher sales to capital ratio for the next 3 or 4 years. But then I'm going to bring it back down because you got to build back for fresh capacity beyond that point in time. And there's one final point in the model itself, for simplicity. I make your reinvestment contemporaneous with your revenue. You know what I mean by contemporaneous? Your revenue growth jumps in year one, your reinvestment happens in the same year. So I'm assuming that if you reinvest, you get an immediate jump in revenues. Some businesses, that's okay, right? Or if you do acquisitions to grow, that's the way it is. But if you're a manufacturing company, remember there's a lag between the time you reinvest and there's capacity. It might take you 3 years. I think, you know, Tesla actually builds its plants pretty quickly, but it takes about 2 to 3 years. So what will happen is you reinvest in year one, but your sales will not start to grow till year three. Or if you're a pharmaceutical company, what did we say your reinvestment takes the form of? R&D, right? So if you want growth in year 10, you got to reinvest now. There's a lag between reinvestment and growth. And you can adjust the spreadsheet very easily to reflect that, right? Because all it means is instead of connecting the reinvestment to this year's revenue growth, you tie it to the revenue growth 5 years from now, you're getting a 5-year lag. Something to think about when you think about sales to capital is that lag and how it'll affect you. In business like infrastructure, the lag between reinvestment and growth is huge. Right, you build an airport, it might take you 6, 7, 8 years before you even see any cash flows. Forget about seeing growth on those cash flows. So when you value the company, there the three key inputs to drive your valuation are revenue growth. In fact, I've kind of concentrated the model and said, give me those three numbers, I'll value the company. At some level, it does simplify valuation. It's revenue growth, target margin, sales to capital. But remember, behind each of those numbers is an entire story you need to tell. And all of the things you need to think about for your company that will determine what inputs you use for your company. So let me close off again with Airbnb. So I showed you what drove my Airbnb assumptions on revenues. I made Airbnb have revenues of $150 billion. Just to give you perspective, you know what Marriott's revenues were last year? About $30 billion. You say, how the heck is Airbnb? Because as an intermediary, you can be much bigger in terms of revenues because you're not constrained by having to build hotels. You make them about as big as Booking.com. And Booking.com is 150 to 200 billion. So it's feasible. It's a reach, but they can get there. I gave them margins of 25%. Why they're an intermediary? So I gave them high margins. And to close the process, I need a sales to capital ratio. The sales to capital ratio I gave them was $2 of revenues for every dollar of capital invested. You often think of intermediary businesses as not capital intensive. I've heard people say Uber can grow without reinvesting. That's not true. They have to reinvest in different things. You know how their reinvestment, what they have to reinvest in? Acquiring entire businesses. No. So when they go out and they buy, to get that growth, they have to. So it's not that you don't reinvest, it's you reinvest differently. And this 1.9 to their existing sales to capital ratio, I'm giving them a little blip. And the sales to capital ratio reflects the fact that if they want to keep growing, they've got to invest in computers and infrastructure and acquisitions, because that's the only way they can get their revenues from where they are today to the expected. And remember, once they get to those revenues of $150 billion, they don't get the $150 billion as revenues, right? I think right now, Airbnb takes 14%. Of whatever you paid. It used to be they collected from both sides, right? They collected from the host and they collected from the guest. They've changed their business model to collect it all from the host. Don't celebrate though, because indirectly the host passes it on to you. But they did it because they didn't want to deal with two people anymore. They wanted to make it one. I think it's about 14% now. It's not, and that's a key part of the model. Could that change though? Yeah, if they get competition from some other technological device that says we'll only take 10% as a host, you're going to say, I'll go there, but there's got to be this networking effect. So VRBO says that you're not going to do it because they don't have enough listings on them. So this is, now that the quiz is over, you want to forget about this class. This is a good time to take your first shot at the FCFF Ginzu model. right? Because these are the inputs you're going to think about. So put the numbers in, do a 15-minute valuation. You can always come back and tweak them. Firm one created. So this company is basically running in place. 10% return on capital is equal. So the new investments are doing nothing. They're getting efficiency growth of 8%, but that's going to be 1 year. So if you go past 1 year, it's going to go to 2%, right? So when you think about just 1 year, you can say firm one and four are both fine. But if you think about this as a predictor of future growth, I'd rather have firm one than firm four, because firm one, that can continue beyond year one. So when you think about quality of growth, you're not just thinking about year one, you're also thinking about year two, year three, year four. And the companies that have efficiency growth, it's a once and done. So if you take firm five, it's actually incredibly good. You're reinvesting nothing, you're growing at 10%, but it's going to be a one and done deal, right? Next year, you'll have a 10% growth, but after that, you're going to drop to zero. So maybe the best thing to do is project out 5-year growth rates for each of these companies. And company one, you'll have 10% growth every year. And company four, you're going to have 10% growth in year one, 2% in years two through five. And company five, you're going to have 10% growth in year one and 0% growth. So that becomes the dividing line and what drives the value of the growth. Yeah. Did you take the quiz and turn it in? It'll automatically get shifted. Remember, your worst quiz gets thrown out. So if you...
In very
I'm
Whoa, I saw the main dream.